And it's Thursday, so it's time for our weekly check-in with Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. He's up at the Mackinac Policy Conference today. Daniel, it seems you're getting some interesting insights into how the financial and investing world views the Detroit auto companies. What are you hearing from the analysts and business leaders who've come to Mackinac?
Well, I think there's a sense that despite the performance the last few years and the really strong profitability of the Detroit Three, that Wall Street really still doesn't give it a whole lot of respect. And I think if you had to boil that down to one single why, it would probably be that they're not convinced that our people have learned the lessons of the crash. And will they be able to manage prosperity? I mean, one of the things I reported in today's column was there's a guy from Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, who argues that we could get to an annual selling rate of 18 million units, cars and trucks, by 2018, which would be, and maybe with an upside to 20 million, which, as you know, Cynthia, that is a record-breaking numbers.
Yeah.
And that would mean much huger profitability for our companies here. So the question is, can they manage prosperity? We've seen them manage through some very difficult times. They've had to change leadership and everything else, and now they're on the other side. They've got a much better business model. But how and whether they'll be able to manage prosperity, I think, is the big question to investors. And it's a question that the only way they're going to be answered is by their performance.
And it's really based on past performance as far as the cyclical nature, the ups and the downs. And in the past, there was a sense of it was still business as usual and they didn't learn hard lessons. But now, when you think about it, especially at General Motors and Ford, you don't have the old school auto guys running the show. You have folks from the outside. And I wonder if that is seen as something that is a positive.
I think it is seen as a positive, particularly at Ford and even at General Motors. Mm-hmm. But I think the difference is that in both of those cases, I think the smart money is on both of those gentlemen are going to be replaced by career people from within their car companies. The guy who's likely to replace Al Mulally, Mark Fields, has been at Ford pretty much since he left the Harvard Business School 25 years ago. A couple of the favorites to replace Dan Akerson at General Motors are all GM people and have been for a very long time, which is fine. I mean, and they're different than some of the people their predecessors. But it's really an open question. And the companies, I think, are a little frustrated that they're not getting as much credit for some of the product and the quality product that they have out there. But it's just going to be a continuing challenge, and they can't walk away from that.
And what are you hearing and what do you think Michigan and the auto companies need to do to build that new narrative to appeal to those investment communities, because they're the folks that hold the purse strings of America?
Yeah. Number one is perform. Number two is to continue to make the case that they are different, and you show that by what you do, by how the products develop, by the results that you deliver every quarter, by the fact that you don't have a lot of excuses, or if you have problems, you cop to the problems at the jump, like Sergio Marchionne did last quarter, yeah. And say, we've got problems, and we know it, we're going to forget it, put it behind us. It's like, to borrow a Red Wings analogy, it's like Jimmy Howard letting one through and saying, you know, I'm going to get the next one. You can't sit there and cry in the cage. It doesn't help anybody. So what they need to do is just continue to perform.
Now, that Red Wings thing makes me sad, so go easy on the Red Wings stuff. Such a sad ending.
we walked into a bar to catch it, and we were there for 2 minutes, and this shot goes in. Everybody turned around and walked out.
And it was like, we don't want...
Not going to watch anybody talk. We just walked out.
We don't want to see the handshake on the ice. We are done. You know, one other thing I noticed in your column today, Daniel Howes, is the gentleman you spoke with from the Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, whose name was John Murphy. And I love that quote. Mm-hmm. He said that the investment community still looks at this as, quote, the crappy auto industry. But he doesn't believe that. So there are converts among those ranks in the investment community.
Yeah, and I've known John off and on for probably 15 years. He's been on Wall Street and is respected for what he does. And I think, and there are some guys out there, both on the equity side and on the credit side, who do believe in this narrative that John's putting forth, that these companies are fundamentally re-engineered. They have a much better operating structure. Labor is not the competitive disadvantage that it has been in the past. And that they think that we got a lot of upside here, which is particularly important given some of the problems you've got in other parts of the world, you know, Europe being one of the obvious ones we've talked about in the past.
Yeah. We're speaking with Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes, our weekly Thursday check-in. And since we last talked, came word that Kevin Orr is looking at the Detroit Institute of Arts and its priceless collection as something that could possibly be used. Give me your thoughts on all of this.
Well, I would amend that statement just a little. I think what Kevin Orr is saying, and other people surrounded with this from the state, from the governor on down, is that they're stating a fact. That is that the DIA's assets are owned by the city of Detroit. And as such, they could be vulnerable in a bankruptcy proceeding. And that's just a fact. And that may get people all bent out of shape, and I can understand why it does. But I've done a lot of reporting up here on the island and talking to a lot of people, and I think the people at the DIA, the leadership, they understand that too. They're also being beaten about the head and shoulders with woulda, coulda, shoulda. Why didn't you take actions earlier? Why didn't you move to protect the collection? Why didn't you create an authority? Could you have created a foundation? As you talk to them and this unspools a little bit, you start to get a picture that, and if we think back to what happened with the whole Belle Isle flap, you know, the whole notion of trying to move a collection that is valued in the billions into an authority, let's say, that was controlled by a board, maybe coming from Wayne, Oakland, Macomb, Detroit, would have been politically explosive and, frankly, untenable. And I think they made the decision that they couldn't go forward. They couldn't go forward with this in the Kilpatrick years. They couldn't go forward with it in 2010 when they were doing the millage and getting that approved.
Right.
And so now here we are in 2013, and this is potentially at play. I don't think anybody involved in this process, based on my reporting, wants to see this happen. Not the governor, not the emergency manager, not the treasurer, certainly not the influential donors or the board of the DIA. The question is, can they get through on the other side?
To the stakeholders.
Right. But as a bankruptcy lawyer that I talk to a lot said to me, and I've heard from other people, they don't care. Creditors do not care where the money comes from. They just care if it's green. And they tend to make a very cold and heartless argument if it gets to that point in bankruptcy court to say, look, you are trying to get us to sacrifice a certain percentage on our total investment, and you're sitting on assets that you are not willing to liquidate. And so the question is, are they going to be able to get this through or get enough creditors to agree to a deal, potentially without touching the DIA? And I think nobody really knows the answer to that. And there's a lot of emotion attached to this, and a lot of people in Southeast Michigan and elsewhere, certainly in the museum world, realizing how important the museum is to them, to their lives, to the potential rebuilding of the city of Detroit. I mean, how do you rebuild a city on one hand and then and beggar it its cultural institutions on the other?
Right.
I think that's a very difficult, if not impossible. Anybody who knows a whit about these things knows that that's a legitimate way to look at things. Now, the other thing that's developing too, Cynthia, I should add, is you're starting to hear some weird alliances here. For example, unions are starting to talk about, well, what's more important, putting bread on the table of retirees and keeping their pensions whole, or saving pieces of art that nobody sees. And that's going to be an argument that's probably going to be made with a little more pitched intensity as we get into the summer.
We will be watching this, and I know we'll be having many more conversations on this topic as this story unfolds as it is. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes talking to us from Mackinac, where he's at the policy conference. Don't eat too much fudge.
I don't ever eat it, my dear.
Thanks, Daniel.
Thank you.